Coming up on Boston Public Radio, outgoing Mayor Tom Menino strikes a deal for a casino at Suffolk. Now that a gambling palace is closer to reality in East Boston, are you counting the days or experiencing buyer's remorse? Then the dumpling, the perfect food. A woman who knows more about what they are and should be joins us to talk about the delights of a piece of dough stuffed with something. And then as we approach Labor Day, dreams of four-day work weeks dance around in many of our heads. But according to recent research, it's no guarantee of greater job or life satisfaction.
Christopher Lydon on possible American military action in Syria. Then Kara Miller on new evidence that food addiction can be just as overwhelming as addiction to drugs and alcohol. All that up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Eastern Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hi, Jim. I thought you were taking flight over there for a minute.
Did I tell you yesterday this week is our 6-month anniversary here at GBH?
No, you didn't tell us.
I just did the math, yeah.
Happy anniversary, Jim.
Well, same to you. So for years, casinos in Massachusetts have been largely an abstraction, you know, sort of an ongoing conversation about the pros and cons financially, turf wars over licenses, bringing the sins and joys of gambling to the Bay State. But as of this week, it's far less abstract. The roulette wheels, the chocolate fountains, Marjorie, the marquee comedians and rock stars are much closer to coming to East Boston because on Tuesday the deal was sealed to bring a resort-style casino to Suffolk Downs. We know Menino's happy, Caesars is happy, unions are happy, but are you? And what are the odds that both the people of Boston and the Gaming Commission will say yes now that Tom Menino is a lame duck? We'll get your thoughts in a minute at 877-301-8970. But first, joining us to describe the nitty-gritty of the deal and its prospects is the Boston Herald's Dave Wedge. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Dave,
how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for coming in. You've written a million stories about this whole casino thing. So what are the highlights, as Jim just said, of this new deal? And does it seem like it's a good deal?
You know, it's funny. I've watched this my whole career. I started in the early 90s in this business when they were just starting to talk about this.
Really?
So it's been going on for 20 years. And I remember my first job was at the Attleboro paper, and I covered when they built that Plain Ridge racetrack. And all these same issues I covered way back then with what's the town going to get. And I remember there was all these debates over whether we're going to get one fire truck or two fire trucks. Are they going to fix up this school or that school? Well, basically that's what's happening here. There's millions of dollars that Boston's going to get from the gaming money. The minimum they'll get is $32 million a year. They expect it's going to be around $52 million a year or more, depending on how good the casino does. And as you know, people can read my story today, it lays out all the things they can spend the money on. But it's everything from cops and firefighters to traffic to parking to ISD inspectors. I mean, it ranges pretty much every agency in the city. So it's really just more money for the city to spend.
And even though it's more money, it sounds like a lot of money, Dave Wedge. When you think about the casino industry and the potential for the amount of money they can make, even though I don't think they're going to make anywhere near the amount of money because of the number of
the
casinos here and in
right.
in the neighboring states, it's practically pocket change for these casinos, isn't it, if they're successful?
Well, I mean, you know, the numbers on Suffolk Downs that the city has said is $1 billion a year in revenue, mm-hmm. $1 billion with a B. And, you know, they're going to give the city $52 million plus there's some other numbers. There's like $5 million for East Boston, but it's less than $100 million. So it's less than 10% of that.
There's no truth to the rumor. I was reading your story carefully to make sure it was – there's no truth to the rumor that Tom Menino is going to be a greeter at this place. And this, I think he's leaving in a couple of months.
Well, the state law does have a cooling off period.
It does, so.
I think it's 2 years. So,
well, the other big thing is that there's going to be this committee appointed by the next mayor, whoever that is, mm-hmm. And three people on that committee are going to decide how to hand this money out. And critics are saying this is ripe for corruption here.
Yeah, well, you're talking a sudden infusion of anywhere from 50 to more million dollars, and that's, you know, 20 million of that's going to go into this community impact trust that's and then 50% of that money is specifically for East Boston. The other 10%, the other 50% can be used on anything casino impact related. The people who are going to oversee that is going to be the city's budget director, the collector of taxes, and the auditor. The next mayor is going to appoint those three people, and then they're going to have to create this gaming accountability office, which is going to oversee the development of the casino and oversee the use of that money. So who's that person going to be? I mean, you know, and are they going to have a staff? Is that going to be a whole new hack agency? It's, you know, more patronage jobs.
And also, do people come in to that before that troika and make their pitches? Say, I want X, Y, and Z, and are there open hearings? I mean, how do you
– To pick those –
not to pick the people, but the people –
Where the money goes.
Exactly.
I mean, I assume there'll be an application process, much like a grant application process. You know, they do this with the Massport money that goes into East Boston now.
Yep.
But a lot of people say that whole thing's rife with corruption and it goes to preferred political types. So, you know, that's how things usually go in these situations.
We're talking to Dave Wedge, who's been covering this, as you heard, forever for the Boston Herald. And was it the Attleboro Sun? Is that the name of it?
Yeah.
But we're all talking as if this is a done deal. And I would agree that had Tom Menino run for re-election, it would be a done deal. But he's not running for re-election. Mm-hmm. There are two more steps after Revere bought into the deal and Boston did. One, the people of East Boston, unless the laws change, which I don't think it will, alone will decide whether or not to move it to the next step. Then the Statewide Gaming Commission has got to say yes. What are the prospects in East Boston? I mean, I know there are two strong sides here, but is this money and I guess the prospect of thousands of jobs going to buy a yes?
Well, if you read the law, you know, the Gaming Commission's mission is clear to choose the project that will bring the most positive benefits and economic development.
Yeah, but forget the Gaming Commission for a minute. How about the people of East Boston?
The people of East Boston, I mean, you know, that, if you read some of the stuff in the Herald today, there's more opposition out there to this than people think. You know, it's not a real vocal opposition right now, but, you know, there's a lot of people that aren't checking in on this because they haven't really been following it. You know, there's a lot of gentrification going on in East Boston, and a lot of those people might not want this. You know, the old school East Boston people, a lot of them seem to want it because, you know, they need the jobs, they need the development and all that. And also, you got to remember the track has been there for 100 and something years. They employ, you know, I think over 1,000 people right now, and it's a really nice track, and they want to save that. They want to save those jobs, all the horsemen's jobs, the groomers, the feed guys, and the entertainment and the
food.
Everybody
remembers one of the great dynamics that I think teaches you more about Beacon Hill than anything I learned in the 8-10 years I was there. When Sal DeMasi was Speaker of the House, there was an overwhelming vote against casinos. Mm-hmm. When Bob DeLeo became Speaker of the House, and wasn't his father either a waiter or a bartender?
He was something
out there in Suffolk Down. When he became Speaker, close to 100 of the people who had voted no on the casino all of a sudden had an epiphany and voted yes on the casino.
Why are you so sarcastic?
You know
and suspicious,
what?
Though, Jim?
No. There's been a lot of speculation over the years as to why Sal DeMasi blocked that. Everything from, you know, corruption from Connecticut, you know, payoffs, to just, you know, he cut a deal with someone to not allow it to happen.
Maybe he just thought it was a horrible idea for Massachusetts, some of us.
But it's definitely there definitely was a radical shift in the legislature when DeLeo took over, no doubt.
You know, when you were talking about saving all the jobs and the groomsmen and stuff, what happens to the horses?
If the casino gets built, the horses get to race.
They're going to keep the track there.
Yeah, they're going to keep the track. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll be in the slots parlor, Marjorie.
That sort of changed my mind about the whole
deal
casino.
Actually includes money to make the racing better and to help stabilize that industry. So there's a financial function there.
Because you do know, when you've been over there, you do kind of get the sense that a lot of the jockeys that are over there at Suffolk Downs, they've been riding horses for a long time, you know, and some of the horses are getting up there too in terms of...
Yeah, no, I mean, you look, it's a dying sport, and they're the first ones to say it, you know, that the revenue at the track is down. But the theory is with the infusion of the casino brings more people there,
yeah,
more people will pay
it's
attention.
Fun.
More
it's
people
fun.
Will bet on the horses, it'll make the track better.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We're joined by Dave Wedge from The Herald, who's been covering this thing from stem to stern. But you know, again, we're still talking as if it's a done deal. I think either you or I, when Steve Crosby, who's the chair of the Gaming Commission, was here, or maybe he was on TV with me, I don't know, one of us asked him the question about if Tom Menino, and I think at that point Menino was still, we thought, running for re-election. How do you say no to Tom Menino? There's a bid in from Milford, as we know. There's a bid in from Everett with Wynn Casinos.
Yep.
The reality is, in my opinion, and I don't mean it's corrupt, but the reality of power, if Tom Menino was running for re-election, Boston was going to win amongst those three communities. But it's not a done deal anymore. There's some mayoral candidates, Walczak, I guess, at the top of the list, Bill Walczak, who opposes it outright. Mm-hmm. Some are, I think Adrian Walker wrote in the Globe today that Dan Conley's an agnostic. Others seem to be, too. It's not a done deal on the statewide level with Menino going to be gone, correct?
No, definitely not. I mean, you know, with Menino as mayor and Bob DeLeo as the speaker together,
that's a very good point.
That's a lot of political clout and a lot of pressure that would have been on the Gaming Commission to get this done for Boston. You got to remember, too, back before we knew Menino wasn't running again, the Wynn project hadn't been proposed. So there was really no viable alternative to
That's
the Suffolk Downs project. That was the only one they had. Now this Wynn project, I mean, it's more money. It's the same amount of jobs. And it's developing a piece of property that is completely useless right now.
That
and
former toxic or whatever, that chemical site over there.
I drove out there. There's like
it's
nothing
a chemical
there.
Dump.
It really is. It really is a dump. The issue, I suppose, for them is the roads getting into that casino, if there were to be a casino.
Well, and something for the Gaming Commission to consider when they're making this decision is that piece of property will never, ever have an opportunity to be developed like this again. No one else is going to come in and just build a hotel resort there and spend $1 billion on a polluted chemical dump. It's just not going to happen.
You know, you made a great point, though. I'm glad you said what you said. What I keep saying, and I've said it two or three times now, with Menino on his way out, it's less of a done deal. You make the point, obviously, as we started to discuss, Bob DeLeo is not an unpowerful figure. He's the right. Speaker of the House. He wants it at Suffolk. So even though it's not quite the same as a Menino-DeLeo couple. Obviously, DeLeo still has a lot of clout. Our number is 877-301-8970. Every poll I saw, Marjorie and Dave, has had a slight majority in favor of casinos. But my sense is it's one thing, as I said in the opening, when it's in the abstract. You're about to bring all these jobs. You don't have to travel to Connecticut or some other state for this. But as it becomes more of a reality, I don't have anything except anecdotal data on this. My sense is there is going to be some buyer's remorse. And we want to know if you're feeling it at 877-301-8970. Do you want a casino in eastern Massachusetts to be located at Suffolk Downs?
You know, one of the things I think is in Suffolk Downs' advantage, though, how many times do you just drive by Suffolk Downs? Mm-hmm. You don't. I mean, you're out there in East Boston. You're obviously driving past it all the time, but most of us aren't. It's kind of, is it Route 1 or Route 1A?
Everyone going to Maine drives by it.
Well, that's a very good point. Everybody going to Maine, but yeah. Except for, you could take the highway,
Lynn,
though.
Swampscott.
You could take the highway.
Salem.
No, I don't drive up that way to Salem. Do you?
No, a lot of people use Route 1A to go up
that
way.
Yeah, they do?
Yeah,
okay.
Cut through 1A to...
I think it's sort of out of the way.
So what's your point? Where are you going with this?
The point is that a lot of people are going to say, that's over there. It's not in my backyard. It's not going to cause me a problem. Right. I am worried about the gambling because everybody knows the closer you are to the casino, I think it's within 50 miles, your tendency to become an addictive gambler goes up and up and up. But we had this... Well, I won't get into that. But my question is, I mean... This does seem like this is where it's going to be. I mean, what does Everett do at this point to preclude the Suffolk Downs from happening?
Well, I don't think that's true. I think both proposals are really solid and really strong and are very attractive. Again, I go back to the mission of the State Gaming Commission. Their mission is to maximize economic development and jobs.
Yeah.
Either one of those projects would do it. Foxwoods, even that down in Milford, that would too. But you know, you look at what's going on out in Western Mass. They've got a proposal for the Big E in West Springfield by the Hard Rock. They've got MGM in Springfield. And then they've got Mohegan Sun in Palmer. Again, the Gaming Commission is going to have to do some soul searching. Are we trying to save a big city, Springfield? Or are we trying to build a resort casino in the middle of the woods like Mohegan Sun? The same thing's happening here. Are they going to philosophically look at it like Boston has the most chance to make the most money? Or are they going to look at it like what I said with the piece of property in Everett? We could rescue Everett with this. So it's a tough decision for them.
Yeah, the more I hear you talk, the more I conclude that the guy who had the best idea, one of the two best ideas, was Charlie Baker. We've discussed this before.
Yeah.
Baker's view was, and I wouldn't say he's an agnostic. I surely, particularly if he runs for governor, don't want to speak for him. But his view has been, do one.
I agree.
Let's see how it goes. If it turns out it creates all the jobs that are being suggested, it doesn't cannibalize all the small businesses surrounding, then fine. Then maybe we go to two, then maybe even we go to three. But this notion that we go from 0 to 60, and I don't mean that literally, but I mean from nothing.
It's going to be 0 to 4.
Plus, right. I mean, because of the slot parlor. Right. Is really a lot. The other person who had a great idea, I haven't mentioned this in a while, Mitt Romney. Remember Mitt Romney's proposal?
Yes, give them a deal in Connecticut.
Right, write a check. Have people of Connecticut write us a check for $250 million a year, in return for which we will not build a casino.
Yeah. No, yeah. It was a great idea. We just got an email, and I should give our email address. It's bpr@wgbh.org from a gentleman from Revere saying, don't forget Revere in this conversation because they will be impacted by this casino.
Well, the mayor of Revere, signed on to the deal. What do they get? $15 million, I think, out of the deal. Yeah. That's a great point.
Plus like $16 million in an upfront payment. Like this is a huge change to a town like Revere or a town like Everett. Boston, I don't think it's as much of a game changer because we've got $5 billion in development going on in the city anyway.
Right.
As the mayor of Everett famously said, when's the last time you saw a crane in Everett? He was only knocking stuff
no,
down.
No, did he really say that? Did he say that?
He did, yeah.
That's a pretty good line, actually.
You know, when you were on vacation, and of course you weren't here because you don't work here every day, Dave Wedgett, we had a woman in here, and I forget her name, but she's an expert on all the ergonomics of sitting at slot machines, how they're created to make you not need to get up and go anywhere. Mm-hmm. The cocktails come. The chair is very comfortable, particularly if you're an elderly person. How all the bells and whistles are scientifically put together to keep you sort of in this daze in front of the slot machine. There isn't even a handle anymore. They're just all...
Press a button.
Yes.
That's right.
And it was really bleak to listening to her talk. And the slots, of course, are enormously... they make a lot of money off these slot machines. And that was the vision. When she was talking, I was thinking, this is the vision we're going to have of all these elderly people sitting like zombies in front of these slot machines over there in East Boston or over there in Everett. And it's sort of a disconcerting
picture. Well, it is, but you have to think about what, you know, the governor talks about a resort-style casino. That's a little different. Mohegan and Foxwoods are not that bad. But I will tell you, when I traveled with Mitt Romney in 08, we went to Michigan, and I took a little side trip myself, rented a car, and drove out to Detroit to check out the casinos just to see what they were like because I knew they were coming to Mass. They're the most depressing places I've ever been in my life.
Really helped Detroit, too, don't you think?
Yeah, it's done wonders for the city.
How so? How so depressing?
I'm kidding. Because outside, you know, you get this beautiful MGM casino,
yeah.
And literally right outside is block after block after block of the worst urban blight you've ever seen in your life. Homeless people pushing carts. It's
well, depressing. The great line
and I
that
think Springfield could be very similar to that.
Or
I
Everett. Quoted, what about Everett, though? Because Everett is a struggling city.
No, but Everett's right next to Boston,
it's
too.
All
Everett
it's
is
a
not
bit of
like
a bedroom
in the wilderness
now.
Somewhere. Yeah. The line that I was about to quote, the
I
guy from
Everett's
can never think of his
bleak.
Name. The guy from UMass Amherst, the great, great line was, who's an anti-casino advocate, said years ago that Atlantic City used to be a slum by the sea, and now it's a slum by the sea with casinos. And as
right.
a kid who used to spend his summers in Atlantic City, it really hasn't done much for that no. particular
Chelsea
community.
Chelsea said it was Clive Barrows, that name ring a bell?
No, Clive Barrows is the guy from UMass Dartmouth who's actually a huge casino advocate. Mm-hmm. He's the guy that does a lot of the polling and
well,
does
I mean,
a lot
look,
of the advocacy
the bottom
for
line
it.
Is there's going to be addiction, there's going to be problems, there's going to be people that lose everything at these casinos. But they're coming. And the question is, how do you turn that negative into the most positive that you can? And that's what the Gaming Commission is going to do. Can you know, is this deal Boston gets, is it going to build enough schools, senior centers, parks, and other things to improve the quality of life for all the people that aren't addicted to gambling?
Yeah.
Can I also say, you know, if people didn't, I know this is a ridiculous view, but you mentioned that Deval Patrick has demanded that they be recreate, what are they called?
Resort casinos.
I told you, I went to Reno. I was in Lake Tahoe a couple of summers ago. I went to Reno. It is, Reno is like a large homeless shelter, for lack of a better expression, and the casinos are even worse. However, some of the best meals at the best prices I've ever had in my life. The shows were great. And for those who can sort of limit their gambling and enjoy the entertainment factor,
well, it's not just,
there's a
I
lot
mean,
there's a lot there are a lot of pluses. The problem is
well,
a lot of people lose money they don't have.
Of these casinos. I mean those Wynn casinos that are out in Nevada. I mean you look at them.
I mean,
everything
seems
to be floating. Right. You know, they got all these reflecting pools. I don't know how they do it. The chairs look like they're floating.
I mean,
the tables look like they're floating.
You know, keep in mind, these ones that have been proposed for Everett, Foxwoods, Everett, Milford, and Boston are gorgeous. They're going to be a world-class entertainment destination. It's not just the gaming. The gaming is the piece of it that, as Steve Wynn explained it, the gaming is what allows them to build such an opulent hotel.
Yeah.
Because the gaming is
so
the cash
money.
Cow. But really, like, you know, it's another entertainment option for, you know, you and your wife might go see a show and maybe gamble, maybe
but
not.
But the only
just go
way
to dinner,
the
know?
Only way they can fund that to
is with the
can,
gaming
is if people lose a lot of money. Right. That's how they make money.
And that's how it works, though. That's how Vegas was built. You
we
know?
Just a caller wants to know if you know, Dave, what's going on with the casino in Taunton.
The last I heard is the Mashpee Wampanoags are still trying to get that federal piece approved.
Okay.
I think they have a new pact with Governor Patrick that they're waiting for federal approval on. That hasn't happened yet. Simultaneously, the Gaming Commission has opened that up to commercial bids. So that process is just getting going where the Gaming Commission is basically taking a two-track approach where they're going to let this federal thing play out with the Native Americans. But at the same time, they're going to just try and develop a casino there commercially in case that fails.
And people should know the nightmare of that for those who think, those of us, and I'm amongst them, the three casinos, even if you don't want any, three casinos is too many, is under law, if a commercial license is granted to people other than the Native American tribe, the Native American tribe, by law, is entitled to build something on its own without state approval to the same level of gambling. So theoretically, we could end up with four casinos plus the slot parlor.
Okay, we got Steve calling in from the scene of the proposed casino on Suffolk Downs, East Boston. Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I have to just counter what I heard Dave Wedge just say, which was that casinos are coming. They're not just coming. I mean, Busby has said that no community has to have a casino if it doesn't want one. And I think we need to remember that ultimately this lies in the hands of the people who are voting. And we have up to three casinos. Up to one casino that could be built in eastern Massachusetts. That's up to one casino. That's a maximum. So we could have zero casinos. So I think that ultimately we inevitability is something that the gambling industry uses to push its agenda.
Well, let me say, Steve, for starters, the only way there could be none, because some communities have actually voted yes that they want them, is, I should have mentioned, I thought this is where you're going, there's actually a group that is trying to put a question on the ballot for November of 2014. They still have to collect signatures,
which
would repeal the underlying law that created the right for there to be as many as three casinos in a slots parlor. But beyond that, some communities have said yes. But you're right. It's not inevitable in East Boston because people in East Boston could vote no.
It's not inevitable. And the inevitability factor, though, is something that I do hear a lot here in East Boston. People say, well, the mayor's for it. Then it's going to happen. I don't cares what I think. And what we try to tell people, and I am involved in the opposition group here, what we try to tell people is, no, actually, first time almost anywhere in the country, you get a vote. You get, one person, one vote in the community that's impacted.
The people of East Boston definitely have the control over this. If they vote it down, it's not coming to East Boston. That's clear. You're correct in that. But make no mistake about it, a casino is coming to eastern Massachusetts, and it's going to be either Everett, Boston,
Milford.
And, unless for some reason the State Gaming Commission decides to not issue the license. But even if that happened, then they would reopen it to bids so that more bidders could come. So there will be one built in eastern Mass.
You know, we got a great email from Barbara from Danvers wanting to know about traffic at Logan, because many people from the North Shore go right by Suffolk Downs on the way to the airport. What's it going to do?
My understanding is that this deal calls for a Route 1A flyover, and I believe there's some sort of plan for a direct road from Logan to the casino, or some sort of special shuttle service or something like that. And the goal there is, conventions and tourists and stuff like that. Another quick, while I'm thinking of that, another point is, what's this going to do to the convention centers, to the Hines and the one in South Boston? Because this thing's going to have a large convention center.
What's going to do the lottery? We had the director of lottery here a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, why would
we have the most successful lottery per capita and in terms of return to cities and towns of any state in the country. There's obviously going to be some trail off.
I don't think so. I think it'll help the lottery. I think they'll sell more lottery tickets there at the casino because.
But where's the money coming from?
For a long time, Rainham Park, when they had the Greyhounds, was the number one lottery seller in the state for decades. They were. And that'll happen again.
But they
do it in between
games. I used to like
that
too, Rainham Park. That's gone completely.
No, it's still there.
Let's assume you're right for the moment, Dave. And I do disagree with you because I think it is a finite trough of money. We spend more per capita on the lottery. We were discussing this.
They have $50 scratch tickets now.
I know, it's obscene. I agree. But where does all the money come from? If we're spending hundreds of dollars per person on the lottery, I think it's $600 or something for every man, woman, and child, and we open casino, where are people getting this money?
You have a theory. The same thing you always say.
What is my theory?
Everybody's going to be eating cat food.
That's probably right.
I think a couple of things. I think there's a lot more people out there that make a lot more money than people think, and I think the black market is a lot stronger than people think. I think if you go to the casinos, there's a lot of people down there with cash, you know?
What do you mean a black market? Black market lottery tickets?
No, no. I mean just people making money in the off the books, you know?
Oh, okay.
There's a lot more of that than I think we know.
And by the way, we should say, in all fairness to this proposal, as we get closer to a vote in East Boston, assuming that's the vote's going to be limited to there and appears it will, we will have the people from Suffolk Downs. Is it Chip Tuttle? Is that his name?
Chip, yep.
Chip and the leaders. I can't, my apologies, I can't think of the name of the group that's been formed, No Casino in Eastie or something like that. We'll have both sides in and we'll have that
Are
debate.
They going to have the floating chairs and tables at Suffolk Downs too, or is that just the Wynn Casino?
I don't know. I don't know about that, but they, I mean, like
I saw them online. It was unbelievable.
Nice. I mean, they're both really nice.
Okay, Dave Wedge, thank you very much for coming in and joining us, because you know everything about casinos. Dave Wedge, of course, is the Boston Herald's chief enterprise reporter and an expert on casinos. You going to go to the casinos when they open?
I will probably make a visit.
Isn't that obvious from this discussion?
Okay. All right. You know it's a slow news cycle when NPR anoints the last week in August, quite arbitrarily, Dumpling Week. And you know it's really slow, and we decided to dignify it. But seriously, Jim and I were not going to turn down an opportunity to talk about dumplings, their history, their global appeal, and where to get your fix in Boston. That's next on WGBH 89.7, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Liz Alessi. I live in Cambridge, and I report here. I've just always been a really curious person. A lot of the more interesting stories that I've found have been things that I just stumble upon because they're issues that I hear people talking about and asking questions about, and I have those questions too.
I really think that if patients know better why they're taking their medications, they're more apt to take
them. My job is to do the digging and find out more about that. Liz Alessi, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Brody, and she is Marjorie Regan. All week on NPR, obviously, there's been in-depth coverage of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. But also all week on NPR, there's been in-depth coverage on the dumpling, because NPR, I don't know why, actually, has decided this week is Dumpling Week. The bad news is that Dumpling Week is almost over, Marjorie. The good news is that Lily Jan is here with us to talk about why the dumpling deserves its own week. She's a chef instructor, culinary anthropologist, and a self-described dumpling aficionado, as am I. Welcome, Lily Jan. It's nice to see you, Lily.
Thank you.
So, Lily, thank you for being here. We all know about dumplings. I mean, I think of dumplings, Peking raviolis. I didn't know till today that Joyce Chan, the famous restaurateur and chef, came up with that name for Peking raviolis, the great little appetizers that are dumplings. But now I understand there's all sorts of different kinds of dumplings and varieties of dumplings and a specific thing that defines a dumpling. So I think we have to start at the beginning here. What is a dumpling, please?
I think a dumpling is a really personally defined item. Uh-huh. In my world, I think a dumpling is something stuffed in a dough. It can't be bigger than the size of about your hand.
Okay.
And it needs to be snackable. It needs to be something that won't necessarily make you commit to an entire meal, but could be a meal if you wanted it to. But it needs to be snacky and a side dish.
You know, when you say a side dish, and you mentioned, Marjorie just mentioned Joyce Chen, who I had the privilege, as a lot of us did, to meet when she was alive and owning that wonderful restaurant out there near a fresh pond. My recollection was, you know, 20 plus years ago, as Marty said, Peking ravioli was an appetizer. That's what you picked. And you generally had it with a meal, particularly if you had kids. When did the explosion of the dumpling in American food happen? Well, there's an obsession with dumplings now that goes well beyond just the appetizer, right?
I agree. And I think part of it, though, is that they are immensely customizable. I think that people are becoming more comfortable with the idea of dumplings and seeing them in different cultures and cuisines. So, you know, the Nepalese have a dumpling-esque item, which is called momos. And the
what is that?
It's like a dumpling. It's just a little heartier because it's colder.
Mm-hmm. What's it stuffed with?
It's stuffed with meat and, you know, variety of spices and flavors, just like a normal Chinese dumpling.
Okay.
They just call it momos. And, you know, the Japanese have gyoza. So there's no shortage of dumplings around the world in the different cuisines. And I think as people have become more adventurous culinarily and, you know, people kind of cross boundaries and fusion foods have come into play, people are becoming more comfortable with dumplings and trying them more. And you know, China's opened up a lot. And so a lot of the chefs in China have come to the U.S. and gone overseas to open dumpling places. So you can see a larger variety.
But Lily, based on your definition at the beginning of this, we're talking to Lily Jan, who is the aficionado in chief of dumplings. And my two kids are Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
However, they love Indian food.
Mm-hmm.
Samosa is a dough-wrapped, snackable, hand-sized. Is that a dumpling, according
it's
to you?
It's totally a dumpling.
Oh, it is. Okay.
And I think, you know, but a lot of people think, oh, well, that's one of the examples. But Indian cuisine has tons of sweet dumplings as well.
That's a great
and
point.
And people often think that dumplings can only be savory. But actually, even within Chinese culture, we have sweet dumplings. We have something called tang yuan, which is eaten normally around Chinese New Year. And it's round, and it's stuffed with a different kind of dough. It's made out of rice flour. It's like mochi. And inside, they put red bean paste or sesame paste or black sesame paste, and it's delicious and it's very good luck. So, you know, there are lots of different styles of dumplings, and I think that that's part of the reason they've become so popular. And I think part of the customizableness is also why, because if you're gluten intolerant, if you are vegetarian, if you eschew certain products, there's a dumpling out there for you.
Yeah.
I love
dumplings
that.
Are us. So where do we go? Can we talk about where you go to get great dumplings?
Of course,
dumplings?
I have a nominee or two. And by the way, we can ask people at 877-301-8970 if you have dumpling questions or you want to say what your favorite dumpling is, or if you want to nominate a place as the best place to go for any kind of dumplings, give us a buzz, 877-301-8970.
And I want to ask you about the best place you think are some good places around town to get dumplings. But also, you know, when you do get the Peking raviolis, you can get them pan-fried or you can get them steamed. It doesn't really matter, does it?
It doesn't, except if you're watching your waistline, I would
say. Yeah, okay. All right.
You can even get them deep-fried, which is really edging on dangerous. But, you know, pan-fried and steamed and boiled are all really commonly found all over Asia for all dumpling preparations.
So is there a place you can go, like, and just have a dumpling meal from beginning to end?
Can I nominate one?
Absolutely.
Gourmet Dumpling House in Chinatown is one of the most extraordinary restaurants on the planet. Am I right or am I right?
Write that down.
Funnily enough, I actually prefer their main dishes over their
dumplings.
But that's not to say that their dumplings aren't great. Their Shandong-style pan-fried dumplings are great. And Shandong-style dumplings is a particular style. And part of the reason these all have different names and things is because of the region that they're from. And dumplings also get named after what they're filled with, how they're folded, how they're cooked. And they also have fanciful names, some of them. You know, the Chinese poets had fun in the days. But I think the Shandong ones at Gourmet Dumpling House are great. I think if you're looking for the Shanghainese soup dumplings that really kind of exploded all over the culinary scene in New York in the mid to early 90s, the Dumpling Cafe in Chinatown, just down the street, is also really great. You know, one of the characteristics of a really good Chinese soup dumpling is that the skin, the wrapper, is very, very thin.
Yep.
But, and you can kind of not understand the physics of how it's suspending all of the things inside. And I think they do a very successful version of that.
So you just mentioned that some of the Chinese poets had fun naming the dumplings. Are there some poetically named dumplings that we should know about?
I think a lot of people wouldn't know that the wonton, as clunky as it sounds in English, is
actually... That's a poem?
No, it's actually the name wonton literally translates to swallowing clouds.
Ooh.
So you should be eating these wonderfully fluffy and light, gorgeously, you know, silken wontons.
Yeah.
What often comes across is not always true, but, you know, execution sometimes leaves a lot to be desired.
Hey, Lily Jen, before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970, what's the oddest thing that you've ever eaten inside a dough that you've called a dumpling?
Well, I've seen some interesting takes on the traditional Chinese dumplings. I've had a foie dumpling.
As in foie gras?
Yes. It was unnecessarily decadent, in my personal opinion. It was very much like gilding the lily, excuse me. It was just too much. And then there was also a black truffle one, which was really just so many things going on. I was very confused. My palate was, am I Italian? Am I, you know, I didn't really enjoy those. So those are some crazier things. But I've had some nice ones, like mealworms actually make a pretty decent filling.
Oh.
I'm afraid to ask, what are mealworms exactly?
Just like maggots. I know that people are eating lunch right now. I feel bad for saying this.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah. But wait a second. They're alive inside the dumpling or they've passed on?
They're done and they're stir fried, so they're a bit crispy on the inside.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can deal with that.
And stir fried with some chili and some tofu.
And what about dumpling places outside of Chinatown, though, that aren't Chinese?
That aren't Chinese.
Yeah. Are there any like dumpling restaurants beyond the Chinese cuisine?
Arguably, I think pupusas kind of walk the line. I think pupusas could technically be considered a dumpling because they're not always very big.
What are those?
They're an El Salvadorian, they're like a corn tortilla stuffed with things, sometimes cheese, sometimes eggs. Some people would call them a sandwich, but I don't think they're a sandwich because you don't actually split them open. And they can be sealed entirely. So there's some great places. I think there's a great place in Austin called Habanero that does pupusas that I think are pretty tasty. There is Punjab Palace in Austin as well that does some nice samosas, as does India Quality. And actually, there's a random Pakistani deli in Mansfield, Mass., which I know is completely bizarre, that has the best samosas I've ever had in
really?
My life.
Really?
What's it called?
I can't for the life of me remember.
One of our people will look up what the name is. One last thing before we get to the calls. I'm thinking about the possibilities as you're speaking, Lu Jen.
Getting hungry.
A knish is a dumpling, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, of
and
course.
And pierogies.
And so you added a criterion here, which is you don't open it up. I mean, you started with it's wrapped in dough. It's snackable, or not quite bite-sized, but a snackable size. But also, the fact that you don't open it, like a sandwich, is another criterion, right?
Right. Like, I don't think you should be able to deconstruct your dumpling.
Dumpling, yeah.
You know, I mean, there are some dumplings that are never totally sealed, like the shumai at dim sum. Mm. It's an open-top dumpling. But you don't take it apart so that you can eat the skin separately from the filling. That would defeat the entire purpose. It comes as a package.
We know why NPR named this Dumpling Week. Every week should be Dumpling Week.
877-301-8970. Is our number if you want to call with your dumpling questions or tell us where great places are to get dumplings. Let's go to Tim from Canton. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
Excellent.
So I want to bring up the Polish dumpling, the pierogi.
Oh, yes.
So there's a place down in Fall River called Patty's Pierogies, and it's absolutely amazing. They're actually featured on, what's that show, Drive-Ins, Diners, and Dives.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a second. This is your Marjorie's hometown.
No,
You've never been there?
I've heard of it. Well, I don't get down to that much anymore, but I've heard of it. Patty's Pierogies.
They go outside the traditional Polish pierogi, and they have Italian pierogi. They have, they have pierogies for dogs there. It's absolutely amazing.
Hey, Tim, in the traditional Polish pierogi, what's the filling? What's the most,
I've had it with cabbage. I've had it with cheese and sausage. It's just, and I've had it with cabbage and cheese. It's normally, that's pretty much it.
They used to have a place.
Tim, thank you for the contribution.
In my hometown, Fall River, called the Ukrainian Club, and that's what they served, Ukrainian food. They served pierogies, even though those are Polish, I think, right? But they served them at the Uke Club, as we used to call it.
I think they're Polish. I mean, the Ukrainians have another one that I can't pronounce, so I'm going to butcher it. But I think they're called Vereniki. Or something, but they look very similar to a pierogi.
They're really good.
And they're also stuffed with this creamy mashed potato-y cheese filling. It is, I mean, pierogies on a day like today where it's a bit cold and damp out are possibly the greatest thing on earth.
So where's a close place to Boston?
I think, actually, I've been to Patty's Pierogies in Fall River, and they're,
it's really
worth the drive.
Okay.
Where did the dumpling thing happen with you? Why did you decide this was part of who you are?
So, I'm a second career person, and I became a chef later after I realized that PR wasn't for me. And I just kind of really kind of embraced my culture. And a big part of my culture, especially within my family's culture, was dumplings. There are photos of me as a child folding dumplings with my grandmother.
Oh, that is great.
And, you know, it's something that my family likes to joke about a lot, but I love dumplings, and it's become kind of a joke within my friends and my families, and it's what I've been known for. I've made instructional videos, and my friend even featured on her blog a dumpling-shaped pillow.
Oh my
that
gosh!
I now own two of because they're amazing.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you about cooking them. It's not that hard, right? You just have to know how to fold them.
It's not. Yeah, it's really not that hard. And even folding them, if you don't mind something that's less than aesthetically pleasing,
right?
It's not that bad. It's, you know, boiling something is pretty simple. You just need to be able to boil water and make a sauce, and the sauce is totally objective. And you can steam them, which is pretty easy, but you have to have the right equipment. But pan frying them is really simple. I mean, all most people do is either you can boil them first and then just put them in a hot skillet, which is what people often do with pierogies, just to get that kind of fat flavor infused. And in pierogies, it's often Polish sausage or bratwurst or something. But I also like to pan fry them. So I fry them in the pan so the bottoms get crispy, get that nice brown color. And then I fill the pan with a little bit of water, cover it so it steams the rest of the way through.
Oh.
And then by the time the water's gone, the bottom re-crisps. And so you get these wonderful crispy bottomed pot stickers that don't feel gummy.
You know, Lily Jen, you mentioned the photos of you with your kid with your grandmother making dumplings. One of the great scenes is if you're lucky enough to be able to go into the back of a Chinese restaurant, particularly a family-owned Chinese restaurant, and you'll see older people back there not just making dumplings, making thousands of dumplings. Their counters filled with the dough. I guess they sort of wet the thing a little bit, drop the stuffing in. That's from this. It's really a beautiful scene.
It becomes like a family tradition. My mom, whenever I grew up in Hong Kong, and when I moved to the U.S., she would come and visit. And when she would come to visit, she would make dumplings and stock my freezer with them. And we would sit around, we'd get all the filling and all the wrappers ready with all of the little dipping bowls for the water for sealing it. And we'd put on Oprah, which is perhaps the not Asian part of it. But we would sit and we'd watch Oprah. And in an episode of Oprah, we would be able to fold and pleat and finish about 400 dumplings.
Well, before we go back to the coals, you just mentioned that frozen dumplings. Yep. There's a big debate about whether or not that passes the test. Where are you on that?
My frozen dumplings are great.
Yeah.
I think there are some really great store-bought brands, but you really, you know, your mileage may vary.
You know where they make them homemade? There's a place called Wong's in Somerville. You ever been there on Broadway?
Oh, no.
Where they make them, and they sell them in packs of about 65.
Oh.
And they are affordable and really, really great. 877-301-8970. Lily Jan is sitting in with us, and let's go to Annette. You're in the car. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Annette.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm almost embarrassed to be thinking this is the first call I've ever made on radio. But
dumplings are compelling.
It's a wise choice, Annette. Go ahead.
Literally, I totally feel your affection for the dumpling. I love the idea of the pillow. And I think what always brings passion to my heart is the baked bao, okay, with the chashu pork. Mm-hmm. I just love it when it's baked and it's golden and the egg white has gone over it. And as a child growing up, having a baked bao was it was the greatest thing I waited for with my aunt, who just recently passed away, and I think maybe that's why I'm calling. It was the thing she would pack me up for college, send me off with a dozen baked baos from a restaurant in Maryland. And then when I found Hei La Moon and on Beach Street, I discovered, again, a really good baked bao.
Bao is another word for dumpling, we should say, right? Am I wrong?
It gets a little controversial at this point. It's a dough, for sure, but it's a rising dough, so there's definitely some kind of leavening going on, and it's fluffier. So it could be considered a dumpling in that it is a carb-wrapped filling, and it's about the size of your hand. But bao, in Chinese culture at least, has a very different designation.
Huh. Annette, that was a great, great, great first call, and you made a wise choice. I hope you'll call us again soon. Thanks so much.
You know, we got an email from Anne, who knows that you're Jewish, Jim, and
yes,
she wants to know about the kreplach.
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 Yeah, I mean, that's a variation on a theme. Yeah, they are. I mean, I never thought about dumplings other than being dumplings until you came in today, but they really are all variations on a theme. Let's go back to the calls. Erica, you're in Billerica. You're on with Lily Jen. Hey there, Erica.
Hi.
Hi.
I think you're all thinking a little too small. There needs to be a national chain of International House of Dumplings. Where, I mean, these days the tapas and the small plates restaurants are all the rage. You need to be able to go into one restaurant and to be able to get little plates, and you can get a pupusa and a knish and a ravioli and a kreplach, et cetera, all in one place.
Well,
I wish somebody would open one of those.
Eric, I can say I've been to such a place in Chicago, and the place in Chicago, the name of which escapes me at the moment, and it is, they are bao, I guess, which is slightly different. They have, not only they have all the international flavors like you're just describing, Lily was describing, they have eggs and sausage inside a bao. They have chocolate inside a bao. They have coconut. And so the answer is some people are onto that, and boy, would that be great in Boston. Is there such a place in this part of the world?
Not for international house of bao or dumpling per se. I mean, you can certainly get a good variety of dumplings if you go to Dim Sum in Chinatown or Hei La Moon, as a caller mentioned. That's a great place for Dim Sum. And there's lots of different places that offer a variety of dumplings on the menu, like Jojo Taipei in Austin as well. I actually thought about opening up a dumpling cart in Boston, but I did the math, and the labor that it would take is not really worth the trade-off. But it is a really labor-intensive thing, so I wish somebody would come up with it. I just wish that they weren't me. So I like napping.
Let's take one more call. Erica and Bell Ricka, thanks for calling.
Oh, oops. Erica was just who we spoke to.
Oh, Erica's the person we spoke to. Yeah. Oops. John from Worcester, then. Hi, John.
Hi, John.
From Worcester.
Oh, hey, what's going on?
What's going on with you?
Nothing, and welcome back. It's good to have everybody back in the room here.
We're all happy to be here. Thanks, John. What's up?
Okay, so I've got an alternate dumpling here. I was totally inspired with this conversation. Thank you, Lily. And I wanted to share my favorite dumpling in the world. I didn't know it was a dumpling, but by your definition, it is. If you ever go to a Brazilian, not the Brazilian restaurant where they serve all the meat, but the bakery,
yeah.
Oh, my God, they have a thing called a coxinha, okay? And the coxinha is, Lily, are you familiar with these?
I think so, yes.
But give us more on it, John. What are they like?
Okay, here's what it is. So get ready. It's this, like, soft corn dough. That's what it's wrapped in. It's sort of shaped like a large tear, maybe the size of a child's fist. And inside is all this shredded chicken with spices. And inside this fried, deep-fried corn dough. And sometimes they put some cream cheese in there. Ugh.
John, what's it? Give us the name of this thing again so I can get one at about 2:15 today. What's it called?
It's a coxinha. C-O-X-I-N-H-A.
Great.
Coxinha.
Wow.
Hey, John, thanks. You know, we're going to take actually one more because Linda from Boston raises an issue that I'm dying to hear Lily Jan respond to. Linda, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
So I think it's the sauce on the dumplings, because often the dumplings are kind of uniform. They're good, but they're kind of the same in any restaurant you go to, but the sauce seems to make it.
How about it? Is that like, I'm worried that Lily's going to say it violates the purity of the issue of the dumpling. Am I close or no?
You know me so well. honestly, I think a dumpling should be able to stand on its own. If you have dumplings in China, they generally aren't very sauced. They don't have a lot on them. They might have a little bit of soy sauce or a little bit of vinegar just to cut through the fat, but it's not a heavily sauced item. I do know that sauce can heighten the dumpling, though. For example, the soup dumpling is always eaten with a black vinegar and thinly cut ginger, and it really enhances the flavor. Yeah. But it shouldn't make or break the dumpling. If it's making or breaking the dumpling, you need to find a better dumpling.
I knew that was going to be the answer, Linda, but thank you for the call.
So when you do eat the Peking ravioli, either pan-fried or boiled, or steamed rather, is it just soy sauce you should put on it?
Everybody has their own personal thing. Uh-huh. Mine is soy sauce, sesame oil, little bit of vinegar, and a lot of chilies.
Oh, that's great.
For people who are not maybe as adventurous, I think omitting that, the chilies at the end, and then maybe a little bit of sugar and some water will really replicate some of the sauces that I know that are really popular in dumpling houses.
Oh, man. Look, there are three smiles in this room, I can tell you.
Lily,
that are...
you should have brought us 4 dozen dumplings, okay? You fell down on the job here.
Are you a great dumpling chef? We should have asked that. Are you?
I like to think I am.
Great. When are we coming over?
You know, the door's always open. I have 400 in my freezer right now.
Is that so?
It's true.
See you later this afternoon. Lily Jan, you're great. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Lily is a chef instructor, a culinary anthropologist, and as you have just heard, a dumpling aficionado. Lily, thanks again for joining us. When we come back, we're going to dash what is probably your mounting enthusiasm for this upcoming 3-day weekend. New research finds that a shorter work week does not make us happier. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
This week on Innovation Hub, Michael Pollan on the rise of the food industrial complex.
The food industry figured out a long time ago that it was very hard to make money selling raw ingredients.
And his realization that germs may be far more important than we think. I'm Kara Miller, Food and Germs with Michael Pollan on Innovation Hub, tonight at 9 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and MassArt Professional and Continuing Education, where you can get creative, get dirty, get involved. Registering now for fall classes in art and design. MassArt.edu/CE. And EBSCOhost Informing the World. EBSCO's technical managers and software engineers use emerging technologies to return results for over 100 million search requests per day. Over 40 open technology positions at EBSCOhost.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. We're having a tough time getting through our post-dumpling discussion. We have to make it to 2 o'clock. You know, most of us aren't working on Monday, and as a result, no matter how much we love our jobs, and Marjorie and I surely do, there's a lot of celebrating. But should we be celebrating? Is the shortened work week all it's cracked up to be? I thought so, but a researcher in Korea says a big fat no. That a 10% reduction in work hours there and a 6-day to 5-day work week, which is essentially a 7-day to 6-day work week, has had virtually no effect on job or life satisfaction. My response to that research is two words, Marjorie. You know what it is?
What?
Labor Day. That's 877-301-8970. Are you buying the research? Or are you of my school of thinking, which is that there is nothing more important that could happen to American life in terms of your job satisfaction, your personal satisfaction, your freedom, your health, your mental health, than a 4-day work week? 877-301-8970. Let me just preclude a certain set of phone calls. We know that there's some emergency types that have to be there all the time. But the notion of a 4-day work week is not that businesses have to shut down, but that they can stagger people so that if there's got to be coverage, there's coverage.
But
you only work 4 days a week.
It's not just that. I mean, when you go on vacation, you go on vacation. Yeah. Somebody else does your TV show or the radio show.
Yeah.
Lots of people have to get so much work done that they have to work enormous hours to get that weekend off. And that's one of the points in this piece, that the stress of having to get that extra work done doesn't make it worthwhile. I mean,
Would it be worth it to you? Would you be willing to live with, as you call it, the stress? And by the way, most people who are behind a 4-day work week aren't saying you work fewer hours. They're saying you probably work the same number of hours, but it's compressed in the 4 days rather than in the 5 days.
Yeah, but just
Would you be willing to endure that little bit of stress for the lack of stress?
I don't think it is a little bit of stress, because people work 8 hours. I don't know that many people that work 8 hours a day anymore, but say you work 9 hours
a day. Most
of them
work more, yeah.
Yes, they're working more hours. So if you're working 10 hours a day already, and then you have to work 12 hours, 4 days a week, I mean, those are 4 days with no time for your life. So I'm not...
How do you feel on the Friday before a weekend where you know you're off on a Monday?
I feel fantastic. But the difference between you and me and these other people is that we don't have to do shows until 3 o'clock in the morning to earn those days off. That's what I'm saying.
And yeah, but I don't... We work pretty long days between the two jobs each of us have. We don't? You don't? What are you talking about?
You know, we're not out cutting stone bricklayers.
No, Marjorie, I'm not saying that our jobs are the hardest jobs in the world.
They are not, Jim.
When you write a cut, what time do you get here in the morning?
I get here
before 9 o'clock.
I get here later
than
you.
No, you get here about 8:30 in the morning.
Every day.
What time do you finish writing your columns on Mondays and Wednesdays?
I work late.
Exactly. So you're working 12-hour days. You wouldn't be willing to work a little bit harder if you knew that you're going to have an extra day off a week.
I just work till midnight 3 days a week.
877-301-8970. I'm not one who believe. I'm not suggesting there's no downside. The plus of knowing that you have an extra day in your life to just live for whatever you want to do with it is so immense that I hear the Korean research. My problem is, did you see the picture of the guy who did the research?
No,
it looks like he's 11 years old. I don't think he even knows literally, Rudolph, whatever his name is, doesn't know anything about work. My view is that with some exceptions where you just can't do it for obvious reasons, the vast majority of the workforce in this country could switch to 4 days and we'd all be better off.
And by the way, they also said that women were happier with the long weekends than men because women have more time to clean the house.
That's great. 877-301-8970. We're talking about a reduced work week, whether it's 4 days or whatever. The research out of Korea, they surveyed thousands and thousands of people affected by this 10% reduction in hours. And according to this one credible researcher, there was no effect, is what he concluded, on job or life satisfaction. Let's start in Haverhill, where Jack is on the phone with Jim and Marjorie. Hey, Jack.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Excellent.
Great.
Oh, I can hear you.
Well, we can hear you, so we're even.
We can hear you.
Go ahead.
Okay. I worked in Manhattan down by the old World Trade Centers in the computer industry for about 20 years.
Yep.
And prior to getting into a management position, we all went to a three-day work week, 12-hour shifts.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed that so much because 4 days off every week gave me the opportunity to do all the things I want to do and not have to take sick time or vacation time to go to the doctor or run errands or what have you. And working 40 hours a week, 5 days a week, it's just, I don't know, maybe it's my age. I'm 55, and I want to retire, and I'd love to be able to do more things that I want to do. And I can't because, you know, I got an obligation to the job, and I think I'd be more apt to be more productive, more upbeat if I worked 4 days a week or...
I agree. Hey, Jack, but respond to Marjorie's point. I was also the point of the researcher who did this Korean study about the stress level. When you were working 3 days, but you're working really long days, 12 hours, I think is what you said, how is your stress level from doing all that?
Well, actually, it was pretty good because I think it's a psychological factor because I was always looking forward to
Amen.
That last day. I was always looking forward to that last day because I would then say, I got 4 days. If I want to go up in the mountains and go backpacking, fishing, camping, whatever, I'd be thinking ahead to that. And I like my job. I think it all depends basically what job you're in. And I really had a great time doing what I did in New York.
Hey, Jack, that was a great call. I mean, you said it. He made a far better argument for this. And I'm like, Jack, I'd like to go fishing an extra day. Well, maybe not fishing or camp. Well, not camping either. In any case, the notion of freedom is...
You want to binge watch that Breaking Bad. Isn't that what you want to do?
I would watch it again and again and again. One of the great seasons so far ever. 877-301-8970 is our number. You know, one of the most embarrassing situations, may or may not recall this. First time you and I were in New Hampshire interviewing John Huntsman, who was running for president, former governor of Utah in the last election cycle. We do an interview with him. I think it was on the radio. We must have been because we were doing the radio together. At the end of which I said, you know, Governor Huntsman, I'm not going to tell you who I'm going to vote for, but if I were to vote for you, the reason it would be is because you're the governor who implemented the four-day work week for public employees in Utah. And it's one of the great things. I'm sure it's working great. And he looks at me oddly. He's no longer the governor at that point. Remember what he said to me? The four-day work week was repealed by the legislature the day before we had that discussion because said, but I've read a lot of research about this over the years because you and I have discussed it a lot. And while I'm not going to be naive or to suggest there are not some problems, particularly in some industries, everything I read flies in the face of this research that was in the New York Times today, that the job satisfaction level is huge. And the point the first caller made, I think, is the biggest point, is psychologically, even if you're working harder for a shorter period of time, the fact that you know that you have extra days off allows you to weather that stress in ways that you couldn't possibly otherwise.
One of the things people often talk about, too, when they have four-day work weeks or staggered work hours is the commute is not so horrible. So you're not sitting in your car, you know, in
rush
hour.
Well, it's good for the environment,
too. Exactly, and you have fewer days of having to burn the lights at the company and all this kind of stuff. But again, like I said, if you have to get this massive amount of work done, I think it's very hard to do that in a shorter period of time. Unless somebody's picking up the slack, as they are for you and for me, they're picking up the slack, Jim. That's what they're doing. They're picking up the slack. Alex from Braintree.
They're trying anyway. Hi,
they're trying.
Alex.
I know it can't be done in your case, Jim.
Exactly.
It's true.
That's what I was thinking.
Alex from Braintree. Alex. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
I'm just pulling into work now, so it's probably appropriate that we're talking about this.
Good.
Yes. So I think that prolonging the work week is, you know, or prolonging going to work on a Tuesday is going to be a bigger problem myself because I just feel like getting it over with is nice. But I do think that the solution to the problem is allowing people to go to work when they want.
Flex time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, if you want to work 10-hour days for 4 days a week, that's fine. And if you want to work, you know, all 7 days and you want to work shorter hours, I think that's I think that's the solution.
Well, obviously, it works in certain industries. It wouldn't work in the radio industry. It wouldn't work in retail, for example, because obviously you have to be there when the customers are there. But it, right. I should say, for whatever it's worth, this researcher who did the thing that was in the Times today, the guy from Korea that we mentioned, agrees with you. He says, well, he believes that the shorter work week is a disaster, or at least not, I shouldn't say a disaster, is that virtually no impact on good things in Korea. He's a huge believer that flexible work hours would be a colossal boon. And by the way, in this country, Alex, I'm sure you know, there are many more companies that have implemented flex time than have implemented four-day work weeks. Alex, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Let's go to Laura in Boston. Hi, Laura. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi, I love your show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm calling because I'm in this position where I work pretty much a four-day work week. I'm, like a lot of other people under 35, I'm putting together more than one part-time job to make up my career.
Yeah.
And I find that because there's still, you know, my schedule doesn't match everyone else's schedule. And as Jim said earlier, you know, everybody wouldn't be working the same 4 days. I'm expected to be working all the time. So even when it's a vacation day for me or a day off for me, it's not for other people. And they're still contacting me and still expecting things of me. So I never feel free.
Oh, Laura, that's awful. What do you do? What kind of work?
Well, I'm in ministry for one of my jobs, and I also work in the theater.
So someone dies or has a crisis and they need you.
Oh, yeah. Oh. All the time.
Well, I'd like to have a great response,
yeah,
but I don't.
That's,
I mean,
you've
chosen at least half of your work life. You've chosen something where you really have to be at the beck and call of people all the time, and that's a tough one. So I guess for you, Laura, you're suggesting it's not a good idea, right?
Yeah, though I would say that it has less to do with the, like, more predictable ministry aspects. You know, I know going into a career like this that there are going to be things that,
sure,
are expected of me off of normal hours. I find it more has to do with, like, administrative things, you know, when I'm expected to be able to return an email in a certain period of time or have some paperwork in before the weekend. It's like, well,
you know what the key, Laura, for you is? The minister part of your life is an unlisted number. I think that's the – hey, Laura, thanks for the call. I got to correct a mistake I made before, Marjorie.
What's that?
I was describing what led to – in South Korea, led to this research. It was a change in labor regulations in 2004, and I got it factually wrong. They reduced the work week to 5 days from six and 40 hours from the previous 6 day, 44-hour week. So it was a 10% reduction in total number of hours.
You know, Laura mentioned one of my things that drives me crazy, though.
What's
is
that?
This expectation of immediate response to email. I mean, that really drives me crazy because then people would have to be, you know, checking their email 50 times a day.
Yeah, but if you're in, it's different. It depends on the business you're in. By the way, the business you happen to be in, the news business, you have to be pretty accessible. She's in the ministry business. She's got to be pretty accessible too. Most people don't have jobs like ours and hers. Most people have jobs
general,
that totally fit, at least in my opinion,
but I think
the notion of a shorter work
in
week.
In general, email, the expectation with email now is that people are supposed to respond to your email very, very quickly. And that's across the board. It's in your personal relationships, it's in your work relationships. If you don't respond to an email in 2 or 3 days, you're sort of a deadbeat.
2 or 3 days? I would say if you don't respond to an email in 2 or 3 minutes, you're sort of a deadbeat. Did you just say 2 or 3 days?
Well, you were like
living
unbelievable.
In such a different
you were
world.
Unbelievable. I'll say something, an email to you about work, and like a second later, it's unbelievable. How do you do that? Don't you go to the bathroom anytime?
I haven't in weeks, actually. It's funny you should say that. It's really been a problem, but I had to respond to the emails. Let's go to Rob. You're in Andover. We'll take one or two more. Rob, you're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Hi there.
How are you both? It's great to have you on the radio. I listen during lunch regularly. Really,
great.
Really love the back and forth.
You're really kind to say that, Rob. Thank
great,
you.
Great content. So my experience is, actually, you mentioned Utah earlier. I grew up in Utah, and I worked for the Utah Department of Transportation in their electronics group. And it never occurred to me that we would do anything other than a regular five-day work week. And they offered for our group, you work Monday through Thursday or you work Tuesday through Friday. That way, every day is always covered because
right.
somebody is always there. And I loved it.
So you were
and
there have, during the Huntsman, part of the Huntsman years, yes?
Yes. And
oh,
just
okay.
before the 2002 Winter Olympics, it was a big deal. So they, for security reasons and just managing the event, they installed hundreds of closed-circuit TV cameras all up and down the freeways, the two major freeways in Salt Lake City. And so it was a lot of fun to do that, but I found what my habit evolved into was I anticipated, I knew that I was working Monday through Thursday. I always had Friday through Sunday off. And I planned my workload so that the major projects I got done by Friday after or Thursday afternoon, and I could relax and have a three-day weekend. And that has also happened here. Now I work for the one of the major defense contractors, who you could figure out if you thought about it for a moment, right here in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And the engineering group has the same perk. And, boy, you know, I mean, I'm Mr. Outdoorsman, especially in New England, love kayaking in the ocean and hiking in the White Mountains and so forth. I know that when I get my workload done Thursday afternoon, boy, I can even leave Thursday night and be there in the campsite Friday morning, and we have time to actually be there and relax.
So does Rob sound stressed to you?
Rob, you sound so happy.
Exactly.
You may have just turned me around completely.
Hey, Rob, that was a fabulous call. Thank you so much, and welcome to Massachusetts.
Stephen just emailed that Jim will have his wish to be working fewer days. As soon as Obamacare is implemented, everyone is only allowed to work part-time so the companies don't have to pay for their health care. Will that make you happy, Jim?
No, well, but I'm telling you, it would be, if that were my legacy, helping to bring a four-day work week to America, I'm telling you. And you who'd thank me first and have to apologize, it'd be you, Marjorie.
Jim, I'm always apologizing anyway, without the four-day work week.
What's next?
Okay, when we come back, Christopher Lydon is going to join us for his take on how the Obama administration is handling the terrible tragedies in Syria. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Back a couple of generations ago, oil and gas companies went plowing through swamps with abandon.
You know, for centuries, swamps were basically the equivalent of wasteland. The terminology was almost interchangeable.
Fast forward 80 years, now we know we need them, so who's going to pay to clean them up? I'm Kai Rizdahl. That story next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, striving to provide patients with expert cancer care, innovative services, and treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer. And pioneers of television. Science fiction introduces us to crazy creatures and imaginary galaxies. But what does it teach us about our own planet? Watch Pioneers of Television, Science Fiction, Thursday at 9 on WGBH2.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Last night, the President of the United States appeared on the PBS NewsHour to discuss what he says we know about the use of chemical weapons in Syria.
We have concluded that the Syrian government, in fact, carry these out. And if that's so, then there need to be international consequences.
Based on those words, it seems, at least to me, it's only a matter of time till the U.S. goes into Syria. This despite reports quoting U.S. intelligence officials that tying Assad to chemical weapons is, quote, no slam dunk, which is, you know, was the term slam dunk, that is, used by former CIA Director George Tenet when he described the certainty of WMD in Iraq. Joining us to discuss this, what may be a march towards war on open mic, is Christopher Lydon. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Marjorie. Good
Hello.
Day. I always say good morning.
Close enough.
So many things and layers here, but I just wanted to pick up where Peniel Joseph ended yesterday in the MLK connection. As he was very disappointed. He said Martin Luther King would be bitterly disappointed at the thought of the day after his anniversary. There we go, you know, celebrating civil rights and almost obliterating the peace quotient of the King story, and then going, you know, guns blazing into Syria. I think it's a problem. I think it's a terribly demoralizing thing that this government, I have to say, this president does to our heads. I couldn't not remember, you know, his acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize and the speech in which he said, oh, by the way, we've got to extend the war into Afghanistan, a step he, you know, he's trying to get out of now. But even at the time, I mean, peace but war. MLK, but extending the militarism and everything else that Martin Luther King was more and more about at the end of his life. I find it terribly ironic. I spent a lot of time in the car on Tuesday, and I was listening to this kind of infotainment of war coverage, and I was just struck how oblivious it was. I mean, all the reminders of the way into Iraq, Colin Powell at the UN, but coming back without any irony. We're not quite sure, absolutely sure, of who did it in Syria. We haven't the vaguest idea of what the consequences could be in Iranian or Syrian responses against American ships in the region, against Israel. Everybody knows it's the world's great powder keg, and yet we're talking casually, mainly about ourselves. We've got to prove that we're moral, or we're good, or we're effective, or we're strong, or that Barack Obama can pull the trigger on these situations. The whole thing is upsetting.
Before you continue, just for a second, since you mentioned the Colin Powell thing, and that's all I've thought about for days, I assume virtually everybody out there remembers 2003, I think the critical piece, the National Security Council at the UN. Here is Colin Powell making the case for invading Iraq.
Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
And the fact that it's only, Chris, 10-plus years since that happened, and that virtually every, well, I guess I was going to say the fact that virtually every American isn't showing some concern, but they are. You've seen the polling data that we've seen, and an infinitesimally small percentage of Americans, even if they believe the chemical weapons were used by Assad and authorized by Assad, an infinitesimally small percentage of Americans have support this, and there's been no attempt to sell them on this.
It's strange. I mean, again, from 10 years ago, no consultation really with the United Nations, no hope of even getting a United Nations authorization for an attack on Syria, no consultation really with Congress. No clarity, as we say, on the evidence, no measure of the effects, no protest either. That, to me, is fascinating. 10 years ago, I mean, in February 2003, I mean, I was there doing my little thing in New York on the eve of the war, but people were out everywhere. This time, there's a sort of numbness. I find everybody I know is kind of seething, as you seem to be, about the fact that we're not consulted. The kind of naked imperial thing. I mean, remember the last time the Prime Minister of Spain, Tony Blair, and George Bush all met in the Azores on the eve, and you thought, this is the Empire Strikes Back. Again, it's France, which has an imperial, old imperial stake in that part of the world, and England, of course, and the United States. So many strange ironies. We're Of course, we're disgusted. We are appalled. We have been for 20 years or more with this thuggish, really mafia regime, family regime in Syria. At the same time, you know, we've just embraced the Egyptian army, which has killed more people, you know, just firing squad effectively in the last few weeks than the gas attacks in Syria.
But John Kerry said it was not a military coup.
It was not a military coup. Yes. We're bringing democracy
to
Egypt.
But the pictures, I mean, I think if you're not an imperialist American, but you're just a regular person that's looking at these pictures on the news, and you see body after body in these little white shrouds, and you see very, very young faces looking up dead, and you see some of them babies, and then you read these horrible stories about the excruciating death you die from these chemical weapons being gas and stuff. So there is part of this is saying, how do we stand by and watch this happen as we have stood by and watched other things happen? I mean, I am no fan of going in there either, but there is that human, we are standing by here.
But standing by, we don't have to stand by. We don't have to stand by, you know, helplessly or ignorantly. I want to go back to the Martin Luther King connection because I thought Peniel Joseph was so strong yesterday on
Peniel Joseph was our guest yesterday, if you weren't listening, who is a professor at Tufts. I'm sorry,
yeah,
Chris.
And a youngish black scholar of American history. But among the things that Martin Luther King said in the famous I Have a Dream speech, there was a reflection on violence. And he said, it's a matter of first priority that we avoid violence, we avoid hatred in this ongoing struggle. He said, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. And you, again, in Syria, you have to say, where is our soul force? Or have we just run out? Can we only send missiles? Other people have said, and I think this is where I would want to begin, with we've got to know a great deal more about the situation in Syria. We've got to bring it front and center into the United Nations. We could be pushing, as Zbigniew Brzezinski said, a kind of tough inquiry in the United Nations on chemical warfare in general. It would be hard not to get a unanimous resolution against the weaponry, and then bring out the evidence in a big public
forum.
But of
course, the response maybe against the weaponry. We can't get a unanimous resolution against Syria, obviously, because of the Russian connection to Syria,
right?
Which is part of the argument why, at the same time, we see David Cameron in Great Britain saying that Parliament wants to wait till the UN inspectors come back this weekend. The president, at least through his spokesperson, through Jay Carney, has said we may not actually wait for the inspectors to come back, which I don't get at all.
I don't get the whole thing, because this is the guy, Obama, that ran on opposition to the war in Iraq, as we all know, and Hillary Clinton was in a different place, and that helped her to lose to him. But, I mean, I don't get why he's doing this. Why can't we wait for the UN inspectors to come back? Why can't – there's some question. It's a small question, but we don't totally know. It was this Assad's government.
It's not a small question. It's not
the rebels. And then you find out these rebels are a bunch of radical Islamists, many of them, and linked to al-Qaeda. So it becomes even more confusing. I don't get why Obama's doing this so quickly.
Well, first of all, he may not be doing it this quickly after all. I mean, he seemed the betting odds on an attack seem to have changed. But I know what you're talking about. There's something very narcissistic about his interest in it. It's about him. It's about, do people take him seriously in the Congress, in this country, in the world? That seems to me entirely the wrong end to begin at. Furthermore,
why do you say that? Why do you say it's about him?
Well,
he's already run two wars.
I know, but it's still projected not as, here's something effective we can do, and here's what will happen, and here's what the results will be. No, it's we must make a gesture. We must assert our morality. We must assert our sort of, it's almost a kind of imperial overlordship of that part of the world. It's about us.
Well, let me add one layer to that. I mean, I happen to agree with you, but for other reasons. And by the way, if you want to weigh in on this whole conversation while Chris Lydon is with us discussing what your thoughts are about what we should do, if anything, about what's going on in Syria, it's 877-301-8970. I think it's got to be put in context for him. One, he's taking a lot of heat for the fact that we helped the Egyptian people protested and brought the first democratically elected leader to their country because the United States wasn't happy with the politics of that particular leader when the military decided to depose him. We couldn't decide, are we with the military? Are we with the democratically elected president? So that's one. Step two is he made the speech quite recently, or made the statement quite recently, that the red line that may not be crossed, his words, red line, right, are if a government uses chemical weapons against its own people. Now it turns out he believes, or at least he says he believes, that that's happened. If he does nothing, particularly in the wake of what happened in Egypt, it seems to me he's worried about being seen. And by the way, I think there's some legitimacy to this, is a paper tiger, somebody who makes threats, essentially, and doesn't back them up, which even if the threat was ill-advised, Chris Lydon, the whole red line thing, he did say it. And if he does nothing after having said that, he looks almost the fool, does he not?
No.
Why not?
What if he went back to the words of Martin Luther King? We've got to assert soul force here. We've got to know more. We've got to act as I don't mean to say buddies, but grown-ups.
When did you have your epiphany, Mr. President? You told us several weeks ago there was a red line. All of a sudden now you're Martin Luther King redux. Where did you have that change of heart? I would like to see that too. How does he explain that?
I think citizens watching the events yesterday had to be thinking about not only our own civil war, but our civil rights revolution in this country 50 years ago. What if you said we're going to draw some lessons from that experience, what we went through? And as I remember, Syria did not intervene in Birmingham when Bull Connor was laying waste to to the protesters. That was a slow, difficult, and heroic, and we feel so powerfully about it now, remembering the engagement of unions, of some white people, churches, but black heroism in their own behalf. I think that's the way these things work. The idea of a missile strike clearing the air in Birmingham in 1963 is absurd on its face. And it's absurd on its face in Syria, too, it seems to me. But, I mean, I think the president could explain that. If he, and frankly, I think his speech yesterday would have been much more powerful if it weren't shadowed by this notion, oh, by the way, tomorrow...
Exactly what I was thinking.
...we'll be pulling the trigger.
You know, it's also another troubling aspect. I think troubling is too mild a word, and then we'll take your phone calls. Is there are members of Congress who are correctly saying, not only do you need to say something to us, which virtually no president does in advance the last 40 years, so Obama can't be blamed alone, but you need to tell more to the American people. And where are they saying this from? From their vacation homes back in their districts. If this is such an urgent moment and there's such deep concern on the part of members of Congress, let them return to Washington. What are they doing? A conference call? The president's doing a conference call today,
yep,
with leaders of Congress about the fact that we may be dropping bombs on another nation. It's just, the whole thing is staggering to me. Number's 877-301-8970. Christopher Lydon is with us. We're obviously discussing the situation with the Obama administration and Syria.
Heather from Harvard, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. Heather.
Hi. I listen to you all the time. I just had to call today because I just completely disagree with your perspective. I mean, the Iraq war, I was out on the street like a month after we invaded. I was completely against it. I thought there was no evidence. But this is a war that's been going on for a couple years, and we get month after month the report of innocent dead people and the protests and the efforts to bring democracy to that country. I think you're underplaying the humanitarian aspect of this particular conflict.
The humanitarian, but we're talking about the missile strikes. What's the humanitarian aspect?
Well,
of
he's saying
strikes?
They're going to. Obama's arguing that this could prevent them from doing any more chemical gas attacks because they're going to take out the sites where they're.
So they'll kill.
Those
he'll
chemicals.
Kill his people with traditional weapons.
Right. Yeah, but that's the president's argument, Heather, as you know.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not saying the missile strike is the way to go, but I think there's an argument for getting involved. I just don't buy the analogy with Iraq. I mean, in that sense, we were being so aggressive. And in this case, you know, we've been sitting by for so long watching people die. I mean, watching the Assad regime kill its own people. I don't know what the right answer is.
But Heather, if I may interrupt, the predicate for our involvement, if there is to be involvement, is the use of chemical weapons by Assad on his own people. And the parallel to what was said by 10 years ago by Colin Powell at the UN about WMD and Saddam Hussein is the President of the United States is saying, as are his people, as he said on the PBS NewsHour last night, that we have concluded, this is a quote, that the Syrian government, in fact, carried these out. And if that's the case, he says, we have to use international there's got to be international consequences. His own people have told the Associated Press in the last 24 hours there is no such compelling evidence that Assad is behind the use of these weapons. That's where, at least I think, there's the parallel, even though I think you're right, there is a humanitarian crisis. Heather, thanks.
No question.
So much for the call.
Well, what about Christopher Lydon going in general? We were talking this morning, Jim and I, about Bill Clinton's interventions and his big regret that he didn't go into Rwanda. That would have been a violent, that wouldn't have been a soul kind of situation. That would have been a guns and missiles kind of situation. He did go into Bosnia. And what do you think about those interventions?
And non-interventions.
I'm not the Secretary of State. I'm not a foreign policy expert. I was dubious about all of them. I think even in Kosovo seems to have been a stroke for peace after fashion, or a stroke for people.
Clinton says he could have saved hundreds of thousands of people from being killed in Rwanda, and he didn't do it. And that there wasn't an appetite, and we could have done it, and it would have been a military intervention, but we could have obviously, the people there were armed with machetes. I mean, we were out, we could outgun them, needless to say. But that's imperialistic too in some ways.
Yeah, I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer, but I'm terribly wary of casting ourselves, even after Rwanda, as the moral scorekeeper and protector of the whole wide world.
Yeah.
I think it's incredibly dangerous. And these are awful situations. But I have to pass on Rwanda.
Okay.
We were not aware of it. The French surely should have been aware of it. The Africans should have been more aware of it. It was not a choice that was presented to the American people and to Bill Clinton even as will you or won't you.
It was, see, that is when you say presented to the American people, I hate to be repetitive here, but it is amazing to me that we could be so close to this kind of action, which could have such huge consequences for both us, the neighboring nations there, and our whole role in the Middle East. And there's been virtually no consultation with the American people.
Yeah, we're getting emails about this, by the way, that there has been this kind of debate in Great Britain. Marianne just was one of the people that emailed about this, and that they're going to have – they were talking yesterday, unless things changed, a vote on
– No, but they said – I mentioned specifically. They in Parliament said we're not doing anything until we have a report from the UN inspectors that, one, their chemical
and
weapons,
wanna,
and, two, that Assad is behind
and
them.
And they also want to debate the matter and vote on the matter.
Hey, by the way, Chris, someone called and said, does Chris Lydon think the UN should intervene? Assuming there was a consensus in the United Nations and Russia was not the obstacle, would the UN be an appropriate vehicle? And if all the nations together decided that military intervention was the right idea, would that be appropriate?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. But go back one step. I mean, my most recent experience in Egypt just suggests how little we know, and then how unconstructive we are, our government is, as a result, in places of great need and tremendous turmoil of every kind, you know, against an authoritarian government, in an environmental crisis, in an economic crisis. The United States, Hillary Clinton came to Cairo when I was there basically to embrace President Morsi because of his very, as I've said here before, his very, very marginal role in the end of the conflict in Gaza. And then she was gone. The message to Egyptians was, as long as you're sort of part of a peace process with Israel, you're our guy. But the rest of the stuff is just too remote from us, and we're not involved, and we won't be involved in a kind of slow liberation of the Egyptian people from their own government and terrible poverty. I think we have to begin in places like that and speak as modestly as people who could be helpful.
Well, the other thing you think about, I mean, you look at our history. We obviously did not fix Iraq. We're not going to fix Afghanistan.
We destroyed Iraq,
Marjorie. We're not going to fix Syria. We didn't fix Vietnam. We didn't fix Cambodia. We didn't fix Korea.
We're not fixing Afghanistan.
Exactly. So that's where I agree with you on this idea that we're going to go in and fix things. We have no idea how to fix things. I mean, the people that are living there are struggling to figure out how to fix things. We don't understand the culture. We don't understand. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would love to revive the anti-imperialist league, the notion which thrived in this country. It didn't prevail against the McKinley-Teddy Roosevelt war in the Philippines. But there was an active consciousness led by people like Mark Twain and Samuel Gompers and Andrew Carnegie and William James, sort of keeping us alert to what is done in our name militarily abroad. I there's a terrific disconnect now that we're all talking about not only American capacity, but what the American military can do and what the American people know.
And there's also no draft.
You know, you mentioned Marjorie a minute ago. What's the objective? Andy Borowitz, who is one of my favorite satirists, and I know Marjorie at the Borowitz Report, wrote this morning, attempting to quell criticism of his proposal for a limited military strike in Syria, Obama floated a more modest strategy today, saying that any action in Syria on the part of the U.S. would have, quote, no objective whatsoever. Let me be clear. Our goal will not be to effect regime change or alter the balance of power in Syria or bring the civil war there to an end. We'll simply do something random for one or two days and leave. And as horrible as the humor is, I think if you were to ask the average person who actually supports this notion of some level of intervention, what is our goal? What's our objective? Right. What do we do? I think the average person would have no clue. Victor, you're in Swampscott. You're on with Christopher Lydon on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Victor.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you for the call.
Yes. So I would say
in my opinion, that President Obama is probably one of the worst presidents in American history when it comes to foreign policy. I don't agree with intervention in Syria. I think it's going to inflame the situation. I don't think it's going to do anything to fix the problem. Over 100,000 people have died since the civil war began in Syria. And, you know, I think the alternative, if you take Assad out of Syria, what's going to come next is actually going to be worse. I think that, you know, I don't agree with the use of chemical weapons in any way, shape, or form. However, I think, you know, these strikes are not going to accomplish anything. Like you said, there's no objective. You know, I think it's going to further inflame the situation. And, you know, our alternative in Syria is worse than Assad, because the most organized groups inside of Syria right now are jihadists. So I really do not see the point right now. And I think, you know, in my opinion, President Obama is really naive.
Victor, you're watching carefully. And in some strange way, I think President Obama is listening to voices like yours. Something's changed even in 24, 48 hours. I think there's a sobering effect even in the White House.
Why do you say that? Why do you think that? Because today was to be the day and it's no longer the day? Why do you think there's been a sobering effect?
I don't know. I think as people hear the chatter, it's apparently there's a rising opposition in France, rising in England. David Cameron is pulling back and wants to be more cautious with respect to consulting the UN. The president's own plans are, I mean, he has not been speaking, but Chuck Hagel and John Kerry have. It's a much less clear intention today than it was on Tuesday.
Victor, thank you for a thoughtful call.
877-301-8970.
Let's squeeze in one or two more if we can. Let's go to Peter. You're in Boston. You're on with Christopher Lydon. Hi there, Peter.
Hello, folks.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Chris, it's great to hear you on talk radio again. Thank you, folks, for having him on.
Thank you.
My thought was, why isn't Kosovo an appropriate analogy here? And I don't think the goal in Kosovo was more than a limited sort of protective action. Maybe Obama needs to talk more about that, if that is what he's thinking. But isn't that a good analogy for cruise missiles, perhaps to destroy the where we think these chemical weapons may be held?
Well, let me just interrupt before Chris says and say that from what I've heard, there's no intention to destroy the chemical weapons. The intention, this again may have changed in the last 40 hours, is to hit some of the military installations and basically to teach them a lesson. So as the president said, and I'm paraphrasing from last night, Peter, on PBS, that they think twice before they do it again. But I haven't heard anybody suggest that even if we stop them from using chemical weapons, Assad is going to stop murdering his own people.
I think that in Kosovo, didn't they just keep bombing until the Serbs were convinced to cease fire and go to the peace accords? That's my recollection.
Reasonable objective for the U.S. involvement here is just basically to prevent anybody from winning and get them to talk to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, I think it's the limited purpose thing. Jay Carney, the spokesperson, said the other day, we're not doing regime change. And again, it's a very – Peter, thanks for the call. The John McCains of the world, actually on the total opposite end of the spectrum, Chris Lydon, and think the issue is not that we're doing planning to do too much, but that we are planning to do far too little, that if we're going to do it, do it.
But listen to what he also said. He said, where is our ability to influence the region? I don't think we can influence this region. I just don't understand why we think in 2013 the United States of America in this powder keg, as you called it, is going to influence much of anything. I don't understand it.
John McCain's force, you know, in American media and also on the president's mind is a mystery to me. Where is the record of success? I mean, heroism in Vietnam and in prison, yes, but success in these adventures, I mean, John McCain would seem to me almost to embody the repetition compulsion syndrome that drives these bad wars. I don't get him, and I'm not sure, you know, he didn't get elected, and I'm not sure he commands the respect or, you know, real feeling or wisdom that his presence in the media suggests.
But don't you think that the generic John McCain is part of what prompts Barack Obama in these circumstances. Well, he can say 1,000 times, and he deserves huge credit for it, he got Osama bin Laden. But the notion is that Democrats, particularly Democrats like Barack Obama, are soft on foreign policy. They're not tough enough. They're not skilled enough. And don't you think John McCain sets off that feeling in liberal-leaning Democratic ranks?
Yeah, but I...
I'm not defending it. I'm just... maybe that's the explanation.
My war is with the... I shouldn't put it that way. What irritates me is the Democrats' own misgivings about their toughness. And people who create... Who take that seriously. I don't think that's the way the government works. I don't think it's the way American politics works. I think we're all, Democrats and Republicans, kind of married with, at some expense, to this kind of war machine and an imperial mindset. And I don't see many Democrats out there that are free of it, maybe a little reluctant. But it seems to me President Obama's real – the job I wanted him to tackle as president was – what I call, and Chalmers Johnson called, the sorrows of empire, the price of empire, the peril, the hypocrisy, the frustration of our over-committed, over-moral, over-arrogant place in the world. I think that's a great teaching sort of bully pulpit assignment that the American people gave him, in effect, that he hasn't taken up yet.
Yeah.
Tell us, Mr. President, let's be real about how wounded we are by Iraq, especially, and the whole adventure with Syria is a kind of child of the Iraq War thinking. We've got to get over that. We've got to see ourselves in a different perspective. And it seemed to me he, with his Kenyan ancestry and his kind of no dumb wars pledge about Iraq, is the perfect person to explain the madness of this militarized policy. Again, it takes us back to Martin Luther King. This was Martin Luther King's campaign in the 60s, and he was dead set and out in the streets against the war in Vietnam. Those are the
which
lessons
I think
that
we're still wounded by the war
absolutely.
In Vietnam. We should be still wounded by
absolutely.
It. And also, I think I said this before, but we don't have a draft, and I think the idea that there are so few people in this country really bearing the burden of these wars makes it a lot easier for us to be cavalier is the wrong word, but you know what I mean. Look at these soldiers that are asked to go back and back and back and back. I don't want my children to go
it
fight
is cavalier.
In Syria.
I mean, it's a cowboy model, Marjorie, and I think we want to be led out of it, away from it. I think Barack Obama is the guy to do it.
And Chris, before you leave, you are probably the most optimistic of the three of us in terms of outcomes here. You seem to be suggesting that what Barack Obama is doing today, at least you hope that he's doing, is rethinking all this and possibly proposing a different strategy. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. And I think that's the message he's getting from Europe. I think it's the message he's getting from American majorities. I think and there's also a weakness in the evidence even of how this poison gas got there and what it was doing that I read on Juan Cole's site this morning that makes it time to rethink.
I hope he is right. And in your spirit and the spirit, as you say, of Martin Luther King, hopefully there will be some second thoughts. Chris
Laden,
great to see you.
Great pleasure.
Thank you for being here, Chris. And Chris Laden joins us every Thursday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. But you can also keep abreast of his great take on literature, history, and politics at his fantastic site, radioopensource.org. Okay, changing gears here. Today we learned a new franchise is hitting Boston. It's called French Fry Heaven. It serves only, yes, French fries. Well, Kara Miller is going to join us up next to explain how French fries and other kinds of carbs and processed foods could actually be as addictive as drugs and alcohol. That conversation next on Boston Public Radio.
I'm Marco Werman. Army researchers work to solve a problem that has plagued soldiers for generations: sore feet. Grunts need boots that'll handle whatever the situation demands. This man's job, making bad boots better.
We try to solve the problems and make the soldiers happy with their footwear.
Flexing them, freezing them, cutting them, even burning them. Building the perfect army boot on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And It's Your Move, Inc., a move management company specializing in the planning, orchestrating, and execution of moves for senior citizens, helping families sort through and organize treasures collected over a lifetime. It'sYourMoveInc.com. And Ring Central, the business phone system in the cloud, now with business SMS text messaging, voice conferencing for every employee, and Salesforce.com integration. More at RingCentral.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Regan. You know, people often joke, Marjorie, that they're chocoholics. Well, it's no longer a punchline to someone's chocolate binge. There could actually be such a thing. New research apparently finds that certain kinds of processed foods and refined carbs could be addictive. Here with us to elaborate is Kara Miller. She is the host of the Innovation Hub. Hi, Kara.
Hi. I am a chocoholic in your midst. I'm actually also a dumplingaholic, so I was listening earlier to your dumpling.
Is that unbelievable?
Wasn't that great?
Well, that's the great thing about dim sum. It's like my favorite meal because it is a meal of dumplings.
Dumplings. It's true. That is great. Where's your favorite dim sum place?
I don't know. I really like China Pearl.
Yeah.
But Chow Chow City, also very good.
Excellent.
And Hala Moon's good,
the
too.
The only problem with China Pearl, you don't have to walk up the steps. You want to go right into it. You know what I mean? You don't have to wait.
Well, then you burn off a few calories getting ready to... Yeah.
Do okay. you park? That's what I want to know. Where do you park in China?
You just leave your car and you run up those stairs. Okay. So getting back to the subject at hand, what is it you've discovered, which is... I have to say, I don't have any of the science, is not surprising to me at all.
I know. This is one of those things where you kind of, in the back of your mind, felt like it was true exactly. that carbs were addictive. Yeah. But interestingly, so Dr. David Ludwig, who's at Boston Children's Hospital here, he wanted to look into this issue of whether high glycemic foods, which tend to be very processed foods, foods with these carbohydrates that have been really highly refined, whether these foods might actually be addictive. I mean, you hear people say, oh, I'm addicted to chocolate or I'm addicted to cheesecake or that kind of thing. But how do you test it, right? How do you really look at it? Well, one thing is you have to remove any sort of inclination that you have. So, for example, I know I like chocolate, right? So if I see something with a Hershey's wrapper on it, I assume I'm going to like it. So, but to really do this scientifically, you have to essentially not really know what you're eating. So what he gave is milkshakes to a dozen people. Some of them were high glycemic milkshakes, essentially extremely processed carbs. Highly processed. So it's the difference, let's say, between white rice and brown rice.
Uh-huh.
It's the difference between a Twinkie and whole wheat pasta, right? One of them is very highly refined. Essentially, all the fiber is taken out. And the other one, there's a lot of fiber. So he had two different kinds of milkshakes, one with this really, really refined stuff and one without the refined stuff. But they had the same calories, the same amount of fat, the same amount of protein, the same amount of carbohydrates, and they tasted the same. And that's really important when you're doing a study, right? Because you don't want people to be influenced by what they believe themselves to be eating.
Right.
And so these were 12 men, all overweight or obese. And it turned out that the way that these really high glycemic milkshakes affected people was that it spiked their blood sugar. 4 hours later, the blood sugar fell. And this part of their brain got activated, the same part that gets activated by alcohol, by sex, by food, by smoking, by illegal drugs. So it was basically saying to them, go back, get more. Right. In a way that they're really that the unrefined carbs were not doing to the people who ate the.
So what does Dr. Ludwig say? What do we do with this information?
Well, I mean, it's only the beginning of thinking about food in a potentially addictive way. So this was the idea here was to really be very fair about it. Now, one thing he's got to test is how does this stuff affect thin people? He only tested how it affects overweight people. And just because it affects overweight people one way does not mean it affects thin people. And you know, when I was talking to him about this, he said, you know, we all know people who seem to be able to eat as much as they want and not gain weight. And other people who don't eat that much and do gain weight.
Yeah.
So it's possible that different people react differently. So it's possible that not everybody reacts in a high glycemic way.
Yeah, but if his concern, if Dr. Ludwig's concern, obviously it's his area of expertise, is obesity.
Sure.
If it turns out, who cares what I'm not saying as a scientist he shouldn't look at this. Who cares what the effect is on thin people who don't have a weight problem? The issue is if you've got a weight problem and part of it is you can't stop eating these refined carbs and all this sort of stuff. And then he concludes that based on my research, he says, part of the reason you do it and then want more is because it's addictive. It's not, I mean, physiologically addictive, not just psychologically addictive.
Right.
That's really depressing. It's even worse than the underlying desire to eat these things, because what you're saying, at least it seems to me, he's saying, is you can't just have one, to use that old line about potato chips. If you start down that road, you're just going to go further and further down the road to eating this crap.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Well, that's really easy for a woman who's never been overweight her whole life, Marjorie.
No, what I'm saying is, you know that a certain kind of milkshake prepared a certain kind of way is it like crack cocaine, then you have the milkshake prepared the different way. I think this is a breakthrough.
I mean, that's one of the things. One of the things that's happened in the last 20, 30 years, right, is the rise of the low-fat craze. And I have to say, when I asked Dr. Ludwig, okay, it's always interesting when people do research to say, okay, how have you changed your life? You know, like, how do you do things? He said he eats a diet that is very high in fat. He said 40% fat.
Because it fills you up.
Because it fills you up.
Exactly.
Yes. And what
kind of shape is he in?
Very thin.
He is. Oh,
yeah.
He is. Okay.
Yeah. One of the things that I think we've seen is we've taken fat out of food and replaced it with highly refined carbohydrates.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And so you think about like snack wells, or I mean, you can get sort of healthy Wonder Bread, low fat Twinkies. You can get all that stuff. But the question is, if you have to come back for more, then what good is it? And so one of the things he says is, yeah, you essentially want to try to eat a lot less of this kind of food and eat things that take a lot longer. So either unrefined carbohydrates or protein, fat, things that take longer for your body to digest. I mean, that's sort of one
and
way. If you know what you're addicted to, then you have to sort of fight back by having things that are not those things.
What do you mean they taste the same? In the milkshake example, I know they taste the same.
Well, that's the thing. If it tastes the same, then you're not like depriving yourself terribly.
Yes. Well, yeah, but there's going to be things like, you know, at McDonald's. I mean, there's no healthy alternative, exactly. Dunkin' Donuts and stuff that tastes awfully good, and there's no real alternative to them except maybe not to eat them.
I think if you have a weight problem, it's probably not good to go to McDonald's.
Yeah, but I can't believe, with all due respect, Marjorie, when you say these things, I feel like my head is going to pop off.
Okay.
All of us, there's...
Because you've lived half your life at McDonald's.
Well, maybe I have.
Not everybody.
How many people do you know who aren't aware that McDonald's is unhealthy for them? Do you
Most
know any?
Most people are aware
okay,
that
fine.
It's unhealthy.
And so if you add up all the people who know it's unhealthy, how many of them are saying, oh, it's unhealthy, I'm not going to go get a Big Mac today. I'm not going to go supersize my fries.
I can absolutely see why you get addicted to McDonald's, because I myself, potato chips, you know, it's hard for me to eat just a few potato chips, and I feel the same way about French fries. You know, you can eat those French fries forever. So I get that why they're addicted to McDonald's, why they keep going back and stuff like that. But, you know, you have to – well, I should shut up because I'm not an expert.
You've never had a weight issue.
You know, and it's not that McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts stumbled into making tasty food, right? I mean, they have taken a lot of science here. They've looked at what the right combination of – they may not know the – exactly, you know, they may not have done the fMRI studies that Dr. Ludwig did, but they understand what it takes to sort of press your buttons, basically, to get you to come back.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that was the next place I was going to go. It's just like the cigarette companies said – we didn't know this stuff. We didn't know nicotine was addictive. We had no reason. And then it turns out we open up their files and we find out they had all this research. Don't you think that they know exactly that these fast food, these processed food companies know exactly not just what pushes our button? My guess is, even if they haven't done as much research as Dr. Ludwig, they basically know that there's some things you can't say no to once you've had one or two or whatever. And that's where they want to direct you. Isn't that pretty obvious?
Well, I would say that no responsible multi-billion dollar company, which, you know, McDonald's is and Dunkin' Donuts and Starbucks, no responsible company puts products out on the market without doing some customer research.
Exactly,
first.
Of course.
Let's be honest. And there's no question they do a lot of research about what really is attractive to people. I don't know how far they've gone looking at fMRIs, that kind of thing. But there's a tremendous science to this. I mean, there are companies that have little vials on the walls that connote all sorts of different things, Mexican food, Chinese food. You would know this by looking at the vials, but you smell them and you think, oh, that's amazing. And a couple of drops of these things can really change the nature of your food.
We have an email from Michael who's totally on board with this theory. He says that calories are carbs and sugars are very addictive added to all processed foods. The truth is that the sugar spike is the real desire by the body, not just the flavor. Try removing carbs and sugars from your diet for 25 days. You won't believe what it's like to have no sugar spikes. So I assume that Michael has done that and it's been successful for him.
Well, I mean, that of course is the idea behind many diets, including something like Atkins. But I talked to Dr. Ludwig a little bit about different kinds of carbs, and there certainly are. There's a lot of sugar in fruit, for example. But one of the things he said is, although it does, yes, spike your blood pressure your blood sugar to a certain degree, it also has a lot of fiber in it. And fiber tends to slow your body down in terms of your ability to digest things. Some things, like a Twinkie, are very rapidly digested. Fruit, less so because there's fiber in it to slow it down. One of the really interesting things that he mentioned was potatoes and how much they spike blood sugar. And he was saying, you know, that really one of the big problems is processed food. And I said, well, but potatoes are a whole food. They come from the ground. They're not a processed food. So you're saying processed foods plus potatoes. And one of the things he said was, yeah, they are a whole food, but over the past century, we have bred potatoes to be the perfect potato for a French fry, to optimize the amount of starch and sugar. So you think about something coming from the ground, but those have been bred and crossbred. He said, if you think about the kinds of potatoes that people ate, like the Incas, you know, like the sort of old school potatoes, you've seen them probably, mm-hmm. those little small purple things. They have nowhere, those are totally fine to eat. They have nowhere near the amount of ability to spike your blood sugar.
And because they're not producing them in the same quantities, producing
that's right.
the perfect potatoes in, they cost about 19 times
Wait
as
a
much.
Minute. So that's right.
So when I go into the supermarket and I get my Idaho potatoes, they're like French fry potatoes.
French fry
in
disguise.
Yeah, they've been.
I'm devastated.
I mean, they've been optimally developed to be fried.
How about those little red new potatoes?
I'm not sure.
Okay, maybe I should stick to those.
Pop in a few of those.
I do love potatoes.
We're talking to Kara Miller
with butter and sour cream.
We're talking to Kara Miller from the Innovation Hub, who has interviewed this guy, Dr. Ludwig, who has done research to suggest that these foods that we can't stop eating. The reason we can't stop eating is because they're actually physiologically addictive. Can we get back to his thing? You said he's on a high-fat diet because it fills you up, it stays, and that sort of thing. Is he marketing that? Is that? I don't mean marketing. Has he written a book? But is he suggesting that's the fix for what ails overweight America?
Yeah, I think he essentially thinks of it as a Mediterranean diet where there's a lot of vegetables, a lot of unrefined carbohydrates, a lot of fat, and some protein. And I think that's the kind of diet that he advocates versus the very common American low-fat, high-carb diet, which for a long time people thought was really good. And interestingly, just at the same time in the, you know, I think the early 90s, as Snackwells was rolling out and these answers to things.
Or the low-fat peanut butter mayonnaise.
Exactly. Ugh. Here's your answer to things. At that same time, you look at charts of obesity in this country and they're going through the roof. So I think people were eating less fat, but they were eating more carbs, and they were probably eating more calories, too, because they were not as full
satisfied
as they once
You know, before
were.
We take a call, you know what would be a great project for you if you haven't done it already? Is when I'm thinking about this, okay, it's not low fat. The cure, the fix is higher fat, assuming it's in a proper mix of things. Is how long, when you finally convince a country, a people, that the solution to the obesity problem is X, and virtually all of us have integrated into our thinking that it's low fat, how long does it take to turn the Titanic around? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well,
I mean, that is the mindset. From
Titanic,
if you were to, well, if you were to,
well,
it's a poor choice of words. this guy were to go on national TV right now and say, by the way, remember that thing about low fat? Forget that. High fat in this context, it would take forever for the average person to say to themselves, wait a second, that can't possibly be right.
Well, there's a central problem here, and the problem is cooking.
Yeah.
The problem
yeah.
is that the things he wants you to do require a lot more
that's
effort on your
point.
Part. And what we're talking about is convenience and fast food, and that's what we're used to in this country.
Let's squeeze in a call. Kim, you're in Cambridge. You're on with Kara Miller on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Kim.
Hey, guys. So great to hear your show today.
Well, thank you.
You know, I started a weight loss program back in January. It's medically supervised, and I've had a weight problem since I was in second grade, and I'm now in my mid to late 40s. And had some kind of health scares and realized I need to do something. Number one, weight is a very personal issue. And if you're not ready to do it, it's not going to happen.
And by the way, Kim, let me not be rude, but we have about 30 seconds. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. I have limited my calories to between 1,500 and 1,700 calories a day. I'm out moving 5 days a week, either riding my bike or going for a walk. And I have cut out all refined carbs.
And Kim, is it working for you?
It is. My taste buds have changed. I just totally love a fresh pear. Whereas before, I was
That's
going
great.
For the ice cream stuff, and it totally worked.
Kim, well, you're
thank
a perfect
you
way to end the show,
very much
Kim.
For the call.
Thanks.
It's very upbeat. Kara Miller, as always, I love to talk to you on Thursdays. And you can hear Kara again. She's host of Innovation Hub. She's on tonight at 9 o'clock, Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. You know what you're talking about?
Yeah, tonight is Michael Pollan and Dr. Ludwig talking about food. And then on Saturday, we're talking about college.
Fantastic. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we're playing a repeat of some of our finer moments. Chris Lydon on jazz, Mark Leibovich on the toxicity of Washington, D.C., I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy. Have a great day. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.